Hi, I'm Ahmed Howdy, and you're listening to Girthari Pods. In this episode, we interview Emma Hinchcliffe, a Fortune magazine writer and author of Most Powerful Women Daily. Hinchcliffe has interviewed many a powerful woman and written extensively on both the challenges women face in the business world and the potential that can be accrued by battling these challenges. Here, her perspectives on what can be done to close the glass ceiling, some trends we are already seeing, and why all of this matters in the first place. Thank you so much for coming on, Emma Hinchcliffe. Can we start by having you introduce yourself shortly?
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for having me. So I am thrilled to be here in Helsinki. It's my first time. I am a senior writer for Fortune magazine. I live in New York and obviously work in New York as well. I've been at Fortune for 6 years and I cover women in business. And so what that means is Fortune has this longstanding franchise called Most Powerful Women that goes back 25 plus years. And I lead our coverage of that franchise. So I write a newsletter. It used to be called The Broadsheet and was just rebranded Most Powerful Women Daily. So please subscribe if you haven't. But we keep tabs on all the women-led businesses to know. And we approach these stories as regular business stories. These aren't stories about like how it's amazing to be a woman and every woman is perfect. These are stories about women because these are executives and leaders and founders who are undercovered and who do not have their stories told in the business press all the time. So we pay attention to them and follow what they're doing and then tell your typical stories about the companies that they're building, who they are as people, and all of that stuff.
Sounds really interesting and topical. Can you tell us a little bit more about what brought you here? How did you end up finding this as your field of interest?
Totally. Well, yeah, like I mentioned, the Most Powerful Women franchise has been around at Fortune for like 25 years, so it predates me for sure. I had done a little bit of this. I used to be a reporter at Mashable, if any of you guys read that back in the day. It was an amazing tech site, kind of not around as much anymore, but still doing some good stuff. And there I covered women in tech as my beat. So that was less focused on the executive level and more about rising women, engineers, and what was happening for women across the tech industry, which was obviously at the time included a lot of challenges. This was in around 2016, 2017. And yeah, and then was able to transition that into doing this work for Fortune, which is more focused on the executive level and on women leaders.
That sounds incredibly interesting. How do you say that kind of transition was from work they did with Mashable and all that towards this that focused more on the leadership level?
Yeah, the biggest transition was getting to know some of these companies outside the tech industry. I think obviously when you think about business journalism and you think about tech journalism, people sometimes have different perspectives. I think people gravitate young people, you know, gravitate more toward tech journalism and, you know, probably read a lot of coverage or listen to or watch coverage of what's going on at Google, Apple, all kinds of tech companies. But there's this whole universe of hugely influential businesses outside of kind of those core tech companies and outside of the startup ecosystem, too, that we hear so much about, including here at Slush. And so getting to know this universe of Fortune 500 companies that are not maybe the sexiest companies, not the ones that grab headlines every day, but, you know, hugely impact the products we use every day. Some of these that are also tech companies but are running kind of infrastructure are not the tech companies that, you know, you hear about in the media all the time. And retailers, you know, which is one area where women have traditionally led more than other industries, is in the retail industry as CEOs as well. So the biggest transition would be understanding that universe and getting to know the key players there.
Yeah, sounds very appropriate. To give a little bit of context, our business goal is 2/3 men, about so. Hence, our audience is also about 2/3 men. Given this audience, would you be able to kind of a little bit explain like why is this a topic that they should care about? Why does this kind of matter, even if they're not necessarily women in business?
Totally. I mean, this is a topic that should matter to everybody because no matter what, if you're a founder, if you're a business student, theoretically, you're going into your career, you want to be as successful as possible, you want to reach as many customers as you can, attract talent. Of course, women are half the population and, you know, women control something like, at least in the US, something like 70 to 80% of consumer spending. So if you are trying to understand who your customer is, who your talent is, especially looking to the decades ahead, you know, you really need to understand what's going on with women in the business world. And some of these women leaders of these Fortune 500 companies or founders or other women who are leading in business and tech, you know, these are people who've had to fight really hard. It's not easy to get to that level. As any kind of underrepresented person, there are a lot of challenges along the way. And so these are often people with really incredible personal stories, whether it's about investors kind of dismissing them when they were fundraising and telling them, oh, I'll check with my wife and ask what she thinks, whether it's about, you know, being sexually harassed by an investor, whether it's about fighting your way up a Fortune 500 or corporate ladder to get to the top. These are really oftentimes stories of perseverance and challenge, and founder stories are often that way. But I think when you're a female founder or a woman executive, there's another added layer to it. And so that can be really instructive for anyone.
Yeah, no, certainly. And it does make for really interesting stories just from an objective perspective. Like, these stories have struggle in them, but also like interesting narratives in general. You mentioned earlier about retail, for example, as a field or an industry where women kind of have a little bit more representation and generally have led in the past. Are there examples of any other kind of industries and sectors that have generally been better about gender inclusion in general? And what kind of lessons can be learned from those sectors?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the startup landscape, I think traditionally female founders have built really strong businesses in the consumer space. That's changing a little bit because I think, you know, in the past couple of years, investor interest in consumer has declined, and that landscape is shifting more broadly apart from any sort of gender analysis. But women are building in other categories as well. Women are building everywhere. I think a lot of female founders are doing really interesting things in tech, in AI. They're doing really interesting things in B2B businesses. That's a place where women are really strong. And then when you look at outside the Fortune 500, I think oftentimes women have been retail CEOs in the past, but I think you can also look at someone like Mary Barra, who runs General Motors, worked her way up and has spent her, I believe, entire career there. And so she's obviously one of the most hugely influential people in the auto industry. So women are making an impact really everywhere.
Certainly. On a larger perspective, you mainly focus on women in leadership. Naturally, it makes for really interesting stories. As mentioned, I think a lot of the writing that I've heard as well that focuses on women does tend to focus a little bit more on the powerful women. In a sense, do you think that that's the most appropriate way to kind of get a more gender-inclusive workforce and business in general? Do you think we should be focusing more on like starting from the top or starting from the bottom of like creating like a general work culture that is more kind of inclusive of women? Or do you think that's like a balance of the both?
Yeah, you know, I think it's all important. I mean, we're writing about the folks who are at the top because, you know, Fortune is a business publication and is interested in the people who have power and are making decisions right now. But when you're talking about the pipeline and what will happen for companies' workforces in the years to come, you know, obviously you have to look everywhere. I think a lot of research has shown that a key inflection point is kind of that first promotion. And oftentimes things will be really equal for men and women in the workforce. And then when it comes to that first promotion to manager, that's where women fall behind. So that's a key place to pay attention to. When you're talking about storytelling, I think having a woman at the top of your company does not mean that problems are solved. These are giant organizations. It's very likely that, you know, a company that has a female CEO also has a lot of women who have really bad experiences, as is the case at most big organizations. So that kind of representation element, that kind of element of making women represent more than 10% of Fortune 500 CEOs, which is about what it is today. And when you look globally, it's about 5% on the global 500, and I believe somewhere around 6% in Europe. That's only one piece of it. It doesn't solve everything. And so there are key things to do, key elements to make change for women and for the benefit of companies and for the benefit of consumers at other levels as well.
Actually, jumping off that point, what are the kind of key steps that you think businesses can do in order to kind of shift that culture? Because a lot of what I've seen and a lot of what maybe has happened in the last few years has been aiming for more gender inclusivity, but not always does it actually pan out in the long term. And therefore, what kind of steps do you think that companies can do in order to make sure that it's not just a target, but more of a cultural shift?
Yeah, I think, you know, women will get a lot of opportunities for mentorship, and having mentors is really great, but sponsorship can be even more important. And, you know, the difference between mentorship and sponsorship. Sponsorship is giving someone opportunities when they're not in the room. Mentorship is helping them and giving them advice and guiding them. And then sponsorship is you're at a higher level and you're in meetings that they're not in, and you're bringing up their name and putting them forward for opportunities. So that's something that's really important. And that's something that male allies can do, is to mention their female colleagues and raise those opportunities in spaces that they're not in. I think, you know, something else that's really important is that there's this phenomenon that a woman, or this applies to anyone who's part of an underrepresented group, whether you're talking about race or sexuality, that, you know, the experience of being the only one is not a good experience for the person who is the only one. And it tends to not really change an organization that much. When you add one woman to a board of directors, to a C-suite, that does not really lead to much change. But research has shown that when you get to about a third of being part of an underrepresented group, that's when things start to change. So something that's really important as well is not saying like we're one and done. Like, you know, we have promoted one woman to this job, we have promoted a person of color to this job, and that is, we're set. Like, you really have to be thinking holistically and paying attention to the culture and making sure that that experience of being an only does not happen for that person, who it is not often a pleasant experience for, and for the organization, which it does not often lead to change.
Right. So kind of like more of like a continuous approach whenever you're hiring or whenever like you're building the internal structure to kind of avoid that leaky pipeline, as it were, to like maintain that balance throughout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kind of jumping off to a different direction. You've actually interviewed really powerful women out there. What would you say, is there one common factor that they share?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of women who have made it really far in their careers, they definitely share perseverance. That is something I think a lot of founders share. But, you know, as I mentioned, I think it is kind of doubly so for women. You know, I did a profile for the cover of Fortune a few years ago about Melanie Perkins, the founder of Canva, which is the kind of visual communications graphic design startup out of Australia. And it is the most valuable female-founded and female-run startup in the world. I believe it's now at about between $26 and $40 billion, depending on who you ask by valuation. You know, she is this person who had this really incredible sense of conviction, started this company when she was like in her early to mid-20s, went through several iterations of it, and has really kind of been heads down, blocking out the noise, stayed in Australia rather than moving over to Silicon Valley, which was a big choice that they made and has really transformed the startup ecosystem in that country. And I think is a really great example of how women are able to lead differently and build companies differently by just having that determination and grit, being able to block out noise, perhaps from experiences of being told no so many times. It really leads to founders who are really able to be successful and make it through challenges.
Do you think that there is something that like women can do to set themselves apart in a way, not to kind of erase their womanhood, but to enable themselves to use it in order to get ahead? Or from my experience, at least, I've had a variety of bosses and managers in the past. And at least personally, I've had a better experience all the time with women as my managers, just because in general, they've been better at communication. They're less easy to temper. And in a sense, do you think that women can position themselves in such a way to take advantage of them being women?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question. There are a lot of ways that women lead differently. It's really true. And there's also kind of a generational element here. I think when you look at the generation that is at the top today, and many of whom are, you know, now heading towards retirement, a lot of those women really felt like they had to fight to get there. And they really felt like they could be the only one. There was only room for one. And the generations coming up behind them have a bit more opportunity and are a bit more open to helping other women come along with them and are less worried about there only being room for one person. And so that's a real generational shift. And I think as well, to your point, you know, in and outside of work, I think women certainly have a certain emotional understanding or EQ that they can bring to the workplace to have difficult conversations, to lead with empathy, with compassion. I think, you know, we saw during the pandemic when a lot of corporate leaders were really tested about and had to be really honest with their workforces and have these conversations about mental health and about family needs and caregiving. Obviously, you can talk about those conversations kind of going by the wayside now as a lot of companies put in, you know, really strict return to office mandates and all of that. But that was an exercise for a lot of leaders in leading more like women typically have, really bringing that kind of authenticity and that sense of who they are as people to work rather than being kind of a corporate robot, which I think women don't necessarily fit in that paradigm. And when you don't fit into a stereotype of who a CEO is, you then have permission to break it. And so women have been able to lead differently because their leadership has looked different in the first place. And so there's no reason for them to just stick with what has always been done.
You mentioned that generational change. Do you think that there is an opportunity to involve women or involve this thought of gender inclusivity from before the workplace experiences, like already from education, thinking, for example, like in university? Do you think that there's something that can be done already on the university level to kind of imbue this care and this attitude of more of a culture of inclusivity?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that can be done. I mean, obviously, we're here in Helsinki. I live in New York. I live in the US, where there's recently been a lot of conversation after the American presidential election around a growing gender gap between Gen Z men and women. You know, men consuming different media than women and men becoming more conservative while women are becoming more liberal.
It's exactly the same thing here in Finland. Massive divergence. So
yeah, well, that's good to know. So I think there is generational change, but that doesn't mean that that's necessarily always change that is going to fix things. There's ebbs and flows in generations. I think even we've seen in the US that what if you're talking about voting, millennials voted more liberal than Gen Zers did. And so it's not like every generation is just getting better and better and better on its own without any work put in. I think people of all generations really have to think long and hard because this is stuff that takes active work, and just assuming it's going to get better, that progress is going to happen naturally, has turned out not necessarily to be the case. These examples are in a political context, but it obviously goes back to the workplace as well. And when you think about, you know, these gender gaps and, you know, why are Gen Z men becoming more conservative compared to their female peers? Some of that does go back to experiences in the workplace of women getting more opportunities. And if men do feel like they're losing opportunities and feeling boxed out, and that's a really complicated conversation, but it's why it's important to kind of be authentic and have these conversations for real and help men listen to conversations like this one and understand why it's important. Because yeah, progress doesn't just happen on its own, and it really takes a lot of active work.
Yeah, certainly. And actually, since you brought up politics, I'd like to touch on that a little bit. To what extent do you think the government should, or policy in general, should play a role in trying to promote this inclusivity? Or do you think that market mechanisms will kind of like sort themselves out in the long run?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my opinion is one thing, but I think we've seen that, you know, obviously, I think in Europe, they've tried quotas for board of directors in terms of the share of women that need to hold seats on board of directors. In the U.S., California had one, and then it was overturned. And I think we've seen that those can be really powerful in terms of the legal landscape. You know, I don't know whether those are going to be feasible, at least in the American context in the future, but one of the silver linings of that getting overturned that a lot of people told me in my reporting was that the quota had been there for long enough that companies had to make progress to keep up with it. And even if it's not in place anymore, the vast majority of companies are now meeting that standard. And it's unlikely that they will, at least in the near term, slide backward on that because they've already put in the work to meet it. So even if quotas don't last forever, it's been shown that they can be a powerful tool to help businesses that have been struggling to catch up because, yeah, I think a lot of companies are not going to do this stuff on their own. I mean, in America, we've seen a big backslide on DEI, and it's become this real political bogeyman. So I think the government can play a role, but what that role will be in the future, I think is pretty up in the air right now.
Do you feel at any level from those women that you've talked to that the quotas might almost have a negative experience on the cultural perception of women in those roles? That somehow a woman who would have otherwise been in a high level position might instead be viewed negatively for having been picked there because of the quota?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's complicated because I think on the one hand, these quotas have been powerful tools for businesses to improve how their businesses run, to have more diverse boards of directors with a more diverse set of experiences that can spot different issues, that can understand the customer, that can really bring value to these businesses. But on the other hand, to your point, it can lead some people to have a perception that, oh, you know, women are getting these jobs because of quotas. That is, you know, I think a really complicated issue to kind of weigh the pros and cons on each side. I mean, I remember maybe 5 years ago, I was at a Fortune event in California we have called the Most Powerful Women Summit. And when I got into my Uber to go to the airport after the summit, that's what I was doing. I told them the name of the event. And the first thing that my Uber driver did was complain about quotas and how it was an unfair rule because that was right when it was being debated in California. So you can see that the difference between the impact on businesses and the kind of way something resonates in the culture can be really different.
Do you think that women who are striving for this high level success, do you feel like they need to somehow be ready to compromise on some things?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot of smart people have talked about the idea that, you know, there's like the kind of age old question of can women have it all, which is kind of a stupid question. But I think, you know, the answer for a lot of people has turned out to be you can kind of have it all in your lifetime, but not necessarily at the same time. And so I think for a lot of women, it's about strategy. It's about deciding what's most important to you at that particular moment in time. And maybe in 5 years, something else will be important to you, whether you're talking about career or family or anything else. So, I think it's something that a lot of women have had to think about over the years. But I think everyone has to make compromises. If you look at high-level male executives, I think, you know, certainly it's probably an easier path, but a lot of people make compromises all the time. So it's not necessarily something that's only part of the female experience.
Right, certainly. Actually, this reminds me a little bit of Milda Mitkuta, the founder of Vinted, had a talk about this earlier, and she mentioned how, like, she left to have her first child. In a way, like, she hated it at the time, but then she was kind of like, I have to do this anyways. I got to, like, change my priorities, and I'll find something else to do later that's going to be equally as interesting. I suppose that kind of approach where, like, you're just going to have to find that most important priority for now. It's not a long-term compromise, more of a short-term compromise, maybe?
Yeah, totally. I think that's a really strategic way that a lot of people think about it.
Generally, talk about workplace culture, or general perception of work. Do you think that this push for more hyper-competitive spaces, particularly in startups and all that, where it's very competitive, very throw your heart into this basket or else not,
Do you think that might put women a little bit of a disadvantage, particularly because of the social expectations that might exist of them elsewhere?
Yeah, you know, I think it depends what kind of company you want to build. Are you starting a company where you're all really young talent and everyone's 22 and no one has kids yet? Then, like, as long as you're careful about building a workplace that is safe and, you know, you're not having a workplace that's full of like harassment, I think women and men in that environment probably have similar needs. But if you're looking to bring on more experienced senior talent, then yeah, you're going to have people with families, you're going to have people who have different needs. So it depends what kind of company you want to build. Oftentimes experience is really valuable. And so not every company is going to be built with only college dropouts. So if you want the best talent later in your company's life cycle, you know, it's going to be important to account for the needs of all people who work there. And that includes people with caregiving responsibilities, which is often women.
Certainly. On a wider lens, what would successful gender equality in the workforce look like too? Or even on a smaller level for like one singular company, what would a successful gender inclusive company look like?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think from our lens as a media organization approaching this, I think what we've often talked about is the fact that, you know, you wouldn't need to have beat like this where you're covering female leaders specifically, because it would no longer be not even unusual, but it would just be status quo. Because I don't think being a female leader today is unusual at all, but these women still are very important to cover, because when you look at the vast majority of the ecosystem, there's still so few of them, or they're still not in the most important positions of power. Gender equality in a lot of ways would look like not needing that. There's just no conversation about it. And women are in these roles. People of underrepresented backgrounds of all kinds are in these positions, and you don't even need to talk about it. But I think we're a really, really long way away from that happening. And, you know, oftentimes it seems like we're getting closer and then there's another backslide again.
Yeah, certainly. And you actually wrote about this recently, just a week ago, about the Fortune 100 list. Gone far, but there's a lot of work to do, as you mentioned. A little bit more like the general cultural aspect of this. What direction do you think pulls first? Do you think that cultural changes on the kind of general level are what kind of create the environment for pushing for more of this gender inclusivity? Or do you think that as companies feel the pressure, or as women kind of push themselves up to the top, do they kind of drag women into the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think culture is, you know, hugely important, whether you're talking about business or politics or culture more broadly. It's a really important factor, but, you know, on its own, it's not enough. In the US, you have a culture that in many ways can be really divorced from its politics. You have culture that oftentimes really celebrates women and what they're able to do. And then you have, you know, a political environment where women are losing rights. So that's like a strange disconnect to be a part of. In terms of workplace culture, I think that's a key factor. But if you have an environment that supports women in like name only and then doesn't consult them on these key issues, doesn't have them in these key decision-making roles, then that's not going to be a full measure of a strong culture. And then I think the same goes as well, where if you have women in these key roles and then you have a culture that is a really terrible experience for junior women in your workplace, then that is not going to be success at all. So you kind of need both.
Mm-hmm. Since you mentioned the political narrative as well, and we've all seen what happened a couple of weeks ago, it's an end-of-day question that you ask from everyone. Do you think the U.S. is ready for a woman president?
I mean, I think when you look at the elections in the U.S., in 2016, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote. In a lot of ways, the country is ready for a woman president. You know, I kind of, personally, I kind of think the country is ready, but I don't know if the political machinery is ready. I wrote this in a newsletter right after the election, but I kind of have a hard time believing that the Democratic Party will nominate a female candidate again anytime soon after losing twice. You know, the country might be ready, but might not have the chance to vote for a woman president anytime soon. Or maybe the country will vote for a Republican woman president, and that's certainly a possibility as well. So, yeah, I think it's oftentimes a question that has kind of two levels to it, about both what the masses are ready for, what the masses want, and then also about, you know, what's realistic and kind of the machinery and the kind of elite decision making that will control whether the country will have the chance to make that choice.
Not to get too sidetracked here, but like on this political like perspective as well, I do feel a little bit bad because in a sense, I feel like the women who had a chance in the U.S. to actually like vie for presidency, whether it be Hillary or Harris, got a little bit thrown under the bus, well, particularly Harris, where a lot of the conversation after the fact has been about like, oh, this country isn't ready for women as president. It's like, she had one of the shortest campaigns in existence. And I could see that also being like a journal step back, which is really odd to me as well. As you mentioned, this cultural divorcing from politics, because here in Finland, we've had women in power, we've had a woman president, we've had women as prime ministers, and no one's bat an eye to it. But then at the same time, do you feel like it necessarily would even filter down? Because we still have issues in Finland with women in positions of power, regardless of if you have women as a prime minister. Do you expect it to filter down at all? Or do you think it almost doesn't matter in the short term whether or not you would actually get a woman president or whether or not you'd get women in a position of political leadership?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does matter, but it is not the only thing. You know, I've also written about this with Kamala Harris's campaign, which is that she seemed to have realized, you know, when Hillary ran for president, she talked a lot about breaking the highest, hardest glass ceiling. The symbolism of the first female president was a big part of her campaign. And when Harris ran, she didn't talk about that at all. It was kind of obvious. The strategy seemed to have shifted to this idea that she didn't need to talk about it. People knew that she'd be the first female president. And voters are ready for a female president, but they don't want to vote for someone because they'd be the first female president. They want to know what that candidate is going to do for them. And maybe the fact that they'd be the first female president is kind of an add-on if they care about that. In running her campaign, she and her team seemed to have really realized that. And obviously, there was a lot of other things going on in this election. So that strategy shift was not necessarily enough to secure a win for the Democrats. But I think it showed that this kind of understanding that applies to the business context as well, which is that having women in positions of power is really important. And when you talk about a female president, that is genuinely really important for like young children who are growing up and who are still forming their perspective of who can lead and what leaders are and if they themselves can be leaders and what leaders look like. And I don't want to undercut the power of that. But yeah, it's not the only thing. And so you can't only have a woman president and then have policies that negatively affect women or not have anyone else on the team who brings a diverse perspective in some way. And you can't have a female CEO and then have a really tough environment for other women in the workforce. That one thing on its own does not solve everything.
Right. Bringing this connection again between politics and business, as you mentioned. Here in Finland, we have mandatory parental leave. It's a parental leave that's given to either parent, and they can choose to split it as they like. Women get a minimum of 3 months, if I recall correctly, but they have a choice of splitting it. In the US, from my understanding, there is no generally mandated parental leave.
There is 12 weeks of federally mandated unpaid leave. So
unpaid
leave for your job. And then major companies have parental leave paid, but it really varies. And oftentimes people will have to take their vacation days, their disability days, go on short-term disability and all kinds of things. And then, of course, there's many workers who that, you know, doesn't reach at all, whether you are working in the service industry as a waiter, whether you are a freelancer and you have, you know, whether you work for a small business that does not have any kind of leave. So yeah, it's a big problem.
Yeah, it's 12 weeks federally mandated, but outside of that, you mentioned that like some companies do offer more comprehensive leaves and like better benefits. I'm assuming you've talked to people in both kinds of workplaces. Do you think that there is a benefit to companies in doing so, in kind of going above and beyond in terms of providing for their female workers' safety and like kind of flexibility?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge benefit. If you want to attract talent, you have to offer the best benefits. And, you know, I think there's a huge benefit in both offering and encouraging or even requiring that men take parental leave as well. I think when parental leave isn't normalized, then women feel like if they take all of it or they take, quote unquote, too much of it, they will, you know, be left behind in their careers. And so it's really only by everyone taking parental leave that it can be normalized that, you know, women have that time as well. But yeah, it's a really important talent benefit and is a really important factor for companies trying to attract the best talent.
What is one story or one kind of like narrative for the women that you've talked to in particular? Can you share like one story that's like really stuck with you from someone's journey or someone's experience?
Yeah.
That's a very open question.
No, let me think about it. Well, I just did a feature story for Fortune on the WNBA. I don't know if you followed it at all, women's basketball, but I think it kind of brought to the fore a lot of the themes that we've been talking about, which is this idea that women's basketball has been really, really growing over the past year. I don't know if you guys followed Caitlin Clark, who came to the league and brought a lot of her fans from her college days and just every single number is up and up and up.
But it is insane how I know a lot of people who did not hear about WNBA until Caitlin Clark.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's a great proof point to be here in Finland and learn about, you know, what you guys have followed along over here. But it's really amazing. But I think it comes with this idea that just because one thing is fixed doesn't mean everything is fixed. And so there's a lot of attention on the WNBA, a lot of viewers, every single number's up, whether you're talking about viewership, sponsorship dollars, merch sales, anything. But there's still a lot of challenges to be addressed, including the fact that basically it comes down to the fact that there's this big lag between this attention and then a lot of the mechanisms to support that going into place. So the NBA and the WNBA signed a new media deal that will bring a lot more money to the WNBA, but it doesn't go into effect until 2026. And so players right now are still making really low salaries in comparison to their role as professional athletes. That was really kind of illustrative to me of some of the challenges that come up in these spaces. Sports is its own world that's really unique compared to the rest of business. But it really showed to me the fact that, you know, you can have amazing things happening and you can have challenges at the same time, you know, and that's okay. That's part of life. And it's important to be clear-eyed about that and to really understand what's going on and what some of the solutions can be in the meantime.
Touching on that point a little bit that you mentioned regarding the wage gap, well, exists in sports at a massive scale. Like here in Finland, I guess we're a little more acquainted to the wage gap in football. Well, in Europe in general, it's an absurd ratio, but also naturally exists in the workplace in general, in the economy. I don't know what numbers exactly are in the US. In Finland, it ranges between like 91 cents between like a dollar about so. But at the same time, you often hear this narrative that like a lot of this is just because of women's choices. They choose to go into certain fields over others that might be lesser paid or more paid or whatever. To what extent do you think that that argument has a point? And also, to what extent do you think that jobs that women do might be underpaid in and of itself?
Yeah, I think a lot of times fields that are dominated by women are undervalued. In the US, if you look at education, you know, teachers are extremely underpaid and women dominate that profession. And oftentimes there's this phenomenon where when a profession becomes female dominated, the salary in that field will go down, the average salary. And so there's this individual level of choices, but then there's also the societal level of how we value what skills and what is rewarded in financial compensation. And so, yeah, I think, you know, you can talk about individual choice all you want, but a lot of this really comes down to the need for systemic change.
Absolutely. Actually, yeah, there's that whole story about computer science, like programming jobs that were like predominantly employing women and paid pennies until men took over and suddenly they became kind of lucrative.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's a great example. I think, you know, the original computers were women who computed things.
Interesting. A little bit wrapping up. If you were, this is going to be very cliche, but if you were to give one piece of advice to women in the industry or women who want to become successful in the business world, what would it be?
Yeah, well, I'll speak from my perspective as a journalist, which would just be to get out there, tell your story, network. I think men are out there bragging and making connections and, you know, on the golf course or what have you all the time. And so just, you know, don't be shy. I think women talk a lot about imposter syndrome and feeling like they haven't, you know, done enough to earn what they have. And that's a totally understandable feeling. But I think it's important for everyone that people who have a lot to offer kind of learn to work past that and share what they have with the world. And so that would be my piece of advice.
I like that. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Kuutari Pods. This episode has been edited by Sam Vitikainen and produced by Ahmed Hewidi. In our next episode, we talk about the trouble with modern dating apps. Why do dating apps suck? What business challenges do they suffer from? And what can be done to improve the experience they provide? Tune in next time to hear from a business startup attempting to create a different take on online dating. See you then.